You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Seth.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing?
Very good. Thank you.
I would think your book just hit the New York Times bestseller list. I'd be doing okay.
Yeah. That's not a bad thing at all.
No, especially with this book. Because I actually think it's a very important book and also a very good read. And that's what we're going to talk about. You've been with us before, I should say, a return guest of the podcast. But your name is Seth Harp, and you are a journalist, also a lawyer, also a military veteran. You served in Iraq. And now you've written this book that's getting so much attention called The Fort Bragg Cartel, Drug Trafficking and Murder in the Special Forces. And that subtitle looks like plenty for a book, but I gotta say, I think in a way the topic is broader. I would say one thing it's about is just blowback, that is to say, unintended consequences of American military intervention that turn out to be bad. And we all have heard about some kinds, like, you know, homegrown terrorism that results from bombing and invading Muslim countries and so on. But you brought my attention to some new forms of blowback. But it's also a story. I mean, it is about all that, but it's also a story about this weird murder. There's a double homicide at the kind of narrative core of the book. So you could start the conversation either way, talking about blowback or this murder. I want to start you talking about something that's kind of at the intersection of the two, which is an elite unit called Delta Force, which is stationed at Fort Bragg. Did I mention the title of the book
I did.
Good work by me. I'm a professional. This thing called Delta Force, first of all, one of the victims of a double homicide and the main character in the story is an elite soldier at Delta Force. His name is pronounced Levine, I take it, L-A-V-I-G-N-E.
Levine.
Billy Levine. Yeah. Delta Force is in turn involved in these various military activities that have these various forms of blowback. So why don't you tell us, for starters, Delta Force is not very well known, not as well known as the Navy SEALs, which is somewhat comparable. So why don't you tell us, like, so it's stationed at Fort Bragg in Carolina, and what is it?
Yeah, it's, you know, while I was writing the book, it dawned on me that there's never been another book that's written specifically about Delta Force, which is kind of crazy because it's been around for, you know, 50 years almost, and is the most elite unit in the U.S. military and is central to U.S. military operations. But its secrecy and low profile is by design, because Delta Force exists specifically to do black operations, or denied operations. Actually, to be really precise, they're called covert operations. That's a defined term in the federal law that sets various parameters around how these missions are done. And it's defined as missions in which the role of the U.S. government is meant to be kept concealed, or it will be specifically denied. So a lot of people may not even be aware that our military carries out covert operations. More famously, the CIA does that. I mean, everyone knows that the CIA does covert operations, may not be as aware that the military does them. But in fact, they do them extensively, and Delta Force is at the leading edge of that. And yeah, as you said, it's based at Fort Bragg and recruits from the Special Forces. So the most elite and experienced Green Berets can try out to be in Delta Force, and a small fraction of them will make the cut.
Right. So you think of the Army Special Forces as being the Green Berets, but this is even an elite subset of the Green Berets. So you mentioned the CIA. So I gather from your book, actually, that just as the CIA's ability to do, like assassinations and things was somewhat reined in after the revelations of the 1970s about what they were up to, eventually Delta Force acquired the ability to do a lot of the things that the CIA now had more trouble doing, right? And so elaborate a little on those. I mean, I was surprised. I think of like Delta, like Special Forces is like wearing American military uniforms, but these guys, they wear disguises. They sound very much like CIA guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the timing of that is very suggestive. You know, the Church Committee's revelations and then the Intelligence Oversight Act, other legislation that was designed or that was passed specifically to put the CIA under congressional supervision and require them to disclose their covert operations to key congressional leaders. Within a matter of months of that legislation passing is when Delta Force was stood up. And Delta Force has many of the same capabilities of the CIA. And one of the most important trends that I identify in the book, although it takes place early on in some of the early chapters where I deal with the historical stuff, is the transfer of power over covert action from the CIA to the military. That was a big feature of U.S. military, U.S. intelligence operations in the 1980s. And that's kind of the origin of where Delta Force comes from, as well as the superstructure around Delta Force, which is called the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC, just so folks don't get confused. JSOC and Delta Force, kind of the same thing. JSOC is a larger body that also includes very select covert units from the Navy, for example, from the Air Force. But the Army unit, Delta Force, that's at its center is really the most important component of it. And they're both based at Fort Bragg. JSOC and Delta Force are based at Fort Bragg.
Okay. And there's, by design, no accountability, right? I mean, it's legal for everything they do to be a secret. They assassinate people in various countries, and we just don't learn about it, right?
That's correct.
Is there a limit on the number of countries? I mean, you might imagine if they're military, their activities would be confined to countries we're at war with. But of course, since we don't even bother to declare war anymore for attacking countries, that's kind of a fuzzy category. I gather at least one point, the category of nations in which they could operate was expanded. And I don't know if it was ever shrunken back. So what's the story on that?
It sounds crazy to people to say there are covert units in the U.S. military that don't wear uniforms and go around the world assassinating people. But actually, there's, I think, an implicit limit on these assassination operations, which is that to date, they've been carried out exclusively in Muslim countries. And I think that because of the incredible Islamophobia and racism of in our society directed towards Muslims, particularly brown-skinned Muslims in places, in Arab countries, I think that it doesn't get questioned, or it just people are more inclined to look the other way or not pay attention to it or not care when they find out, oh, these assassinations are taking place in Somalia and Syria and Yemen and Iraq. That said, the JSOC now operates in Ukraine and probably in Russia, possibly directly, possibly through proxies. I don't know. So there is some expansion beyond the Islamic world, but for 20 years, it was entirely confined to the Islamic world, from the Philippines all the way to, you know, Algeria and Mauritania.
So nominally, I mean, according to the rules, they are allowed to go into any country where they suspect what Al-Qaeda operation. I mean, they kind of have to suspect a certain kind of terrorist operation or activity, and then they can go do what they want. Is that it?
Yeah, their lawyers have to recite the proper mumbo jumbo. From the outside, it seems like they can just do whatever they want. But I think that internally, they have a sort of legal architecture that they take very seriously, even though it in practice is not a real constraint on them. But essentially, their authorities boil down to executive orders that went in place originally in the 1980s under Reagan and Bush. But that really acquired teeth under George W. Bush. And then Obama also sort of loosened the restrictions around them. And then Trump even more so has loosened the restrictions to a degree that's truly unprecedented. So we don't know exactly what those executive orders say that allow JSOC to carry out lethal operations. But originally, the gist of them was that if U.S. intelligence deemed someone to be a terrorist, if they unilaterally determine that you're a terrorist, then they can use the deadly force against you preemptive self-defense is a key term, that Orwellian term that we became familiar with in the early 2000s. But it was then expanded to include the facilitators, financiers, and safe haven providers of anyone who falls in this terrorist category. Then under Obama, the category was, according to the best reporting I've seen, it was expanded to include anyone who was found to pose a threat to Americans. And then as fuzzy as that was, Trump dropped even that requirement and delegated authority to do assassinations to officers in the field. And that's where we're believed to be now.
So like a, what, lieutenant colonel, captain major, lieutenant? Well, I guess you'd expect it to go pretty high in chain of command, decide that we're going to assassinate somebody, but I don't know.
That's a great question. I don't know where, who exactly is making those determinations, at what level. Delta Force is commanded by a colonel, which is a relatively middling rank, because, you know, it's an operational unit. Of course, it falls underneath a chain generals who are very much plugged into what Delta's doing. So it could be anywhere. It could be as low as, you know, the colonel level, but I really don't want to speculate on that. What I can tell you is that Delta Force is actively doing assassination missions right now in Iraq and Syria and Somalia. Making the calls on those? I'm not sure.
Although sometimes you say in the book, they act on direct orders from the White House. But we don't know when, I guess. And we should say that a lot of these are happening in a kind of wartime environment. I mean, when you think of assassination, you think of a guy in a building with a rifle, maybe. But, a lot of these are on what are called night raids, like during, you know, in Iraq or whatever. And you said the rules of engagement on one of these so-called night raids are that they can kill and are expected to kill, basically, I guess, you know, unless somebody somehow preemptively surrenders. But they go in, they kill the target and any military age males in the building, right? That's part of the instruction.
So JSOC's rules of engagement are classified, and we don't know exactly what they are. But what I can tell you is that, well, let me say this. When my book was first published, there was some pushback from the special operations community, people that are online, you know, podcaster types and people in that orbit. Many of them saying that I overemphasize the degree to which these operations are lethal and gave short shrift to the reality, in their words, and that many of the operations end in captures. And then oftentimes they are explicitly ordered to capture the target. Now I don't know that it's a bit of a quibble, because I do talk about capture operations and I do disclose that they capture. But what I want to say is that shortly after the book was published, a guy who went to rehab with Billy Levine, my main character, Delta Force operator, who was found murdered on Fort Bragg, a guy who went to rehab with him in Texas sent me a copy of this memoir that he had written, which I talk about the existence of this text in the book, but I never had got my hands on a copy.
But you've gotten that since you wrote the book?
Yes.
Whoa.
Yeah, I just read it 3 days ago for the first time. It's 158 pages, single-spaced, and it was a singular experience to have written this book about this guy and then to read, in his own words, an account of all of these events that I spent years investigating. And one of the things that deeply impressed me is when he's talking about his career in Delta Force, he, on three occasions in this book, or in this memoir, it's a Word document, he describes committing illegal killings on spec, where they show up at a target and he describes personally killing somebody who was either wounded or unarmed. And he makes no apologies for this and says it in a very casual way. And this is one more, there's a lot of evidence in the book that Delta Force in Iraq and Syria operated just like a death squad. and slaughtered countless people. And that many of the raids were just massacres. But this was one more piece of evidence. I'll tell you one example that he gave. There was a raid in Syria in 2015 that targeted an ISIS commander named Abu Sayyaf. This is well known. This was reported in the New York Times that this happened. This was a national event that precipitated the U.S. Partial invasion and partial occupation of Syria. Billy Levine, I knew he had been on that raid because I have his enlistment record and the timeline matched. But he wrote in this incredible firsthand account of it, incredible just because it's amazing that someone who was involved in that described it in such detail. And among other things, he says that when they raided the compound, actually he said that they had specific orders to take Abu Sayyaf alive, mm-hmm. just as we're talking about. But that one of the operators ended up shooting him dead because he apparently reached for a pistol. Meanwhile, Billy Levine's in another room and a prisoner is brought to him, a prisoner that is had been attacked by a Delta Force attack dog. Billy Levine was a dog handler and Delta uses dogs in everything that they do, war dogs that are trained to attack and to kill. So he's brought a prisoner who's been attacked by one of these dogs and is bleeding, his arms all ripped up. And he's unarmed. Billy writes in his memoir specifically that the man had his hands up behind or beside his head. And he says that he pushed the guy's hair out of his face because he had long hair. And after seeing that it was not Abu Sayyaf, that he just shot him in the head and killed him and splattered his brains all over the room.
Did he explain why?
He didn't say anything. That's what, you know, I'm saying, and this was one of three points in his memoir where he just, as if it's just understood, as if it's just completely casual. So that's another piece of evidence that leads me to believe that their rules of engagement are very flexible and that most of the time when they hit a target, everybody there dies.
Wow. So in a way, I'm surprised because he seems to, in some respects, you know, have a conscience. He's having doubts as his death approaches about the whole operation that he's been part of. I mean, I gather the wisdom of some of this or the whatever. And that leads to one theory about why he was killed, who the murderer was. You know, one argument is he knew too much. He sounded like he was going to maybe head south and start talking about what he'd seen. And he had said to people he was writing a book and so on. So that's one theory. Before we get to the theories and everything, though, why don't we back up and why don't you just tell us about the murder, about Billy Levine, how he winds up dead, and so on.
Sure. I mean, that's how I first heard about this story was just reading in the New York Times that there had been two special operations soldiers who were found dead on Fort Bragg. And one of them was Billy Levine. The other one was Timothy Dumas, by the way. So a whole separate story to whom I dedicate several chapters of the book. But Billy,
he is a former soldier.
True.
And now a drug dealer.
Right. He was not on active duty at the time of his death. But he had been in the Army for 19 years and was an integral part of the Fort Bragg community and remained, you know, a resident there. But Levine, you know, I learned in that same article, it disclosed a very curious fact. Well, first of all, it said that this is believed to have been a drug deal gone wrong. So that already has my antenna perked up. You're telling me that two special ops soldiers, what, got in a gunfight over drugs on base? That's crazy. But beyond that, it also said that Levine had previously killed a guy at his house in Fayetteville. He had killed a fellow Green Beret, shot him, and it had been ruled a justified homicide. That's all that the article said. And that guy's name was Mark Leshiker. So just 18 months before he himself was killed, Levine had killed somebody and then the police had ruled it to be a justified homicide. And the fact that Levine was a member of Delta Force to me really clinched it because in the years that I had spent as a war reporter or even serving in the military myself before that, I had never heard of anyone in Delta Force being in the news for any reason. It was the first time I'd ever seen that happen. So at that point, I thought, you know, there must be a lot more to this story.
Mm-hmm. And you start the book with that, with Levine killing Leshinger is the name.
Leshinger, yeah.
Good friend of his kills him in front of their daughters. It's not like a cold-blooded, I mean, you can characterize it however you want, but Lessinger had kind of gone crazy. They'd both done a ton of drugs, and Lessinger was having paranoid hallucinations, and they had a fight outside. I mean, like a hand-to-hand fight, and Billy retreats into the house with the daughters. The guy finally finds a way to come in. Billy Levine says, you know, he felt threatened by him, whatever. And then, as you know, in the book, some of the stories about why he felt threatened clearly don't pan out. And before we move on to the double homicide, I mean, one thing you learn through that story is, like, these guys just get special protection. And not just from military police, but from, it sounds like, sometimes at least, the civilian police authorities in the adjacent town. These guys can get away with a lot without winding up in jail.
Absolutely. That's one of the major themes of the book, is showing how time and again, Delta Force soldiers or Green Berets show up at the Cumberland County Sheriff's Station or the Fayetteville Police Station in handcuffs, accused of serious crimes, and then for whatever reason, the charges just get dropped. And folks can quibble with one case or another and say, well, there were, you know, the evidence was bad, or there was these extenuating circumstances. But it's really the larger pattern that I'm trying to draw attention to and show that, hey, these guys have, when they have been in Delta Force, you know, Billy Levine had done 14 deployments in his career. He had been in Delta Force for 10 years. He had been on these high-profile raids like the killing of Abu Sayyaf. And you can just imagine the national security concerns about having a guy like that in a courtroom or in a prison. And you could see why there would be a strong, strong incentive to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah, you want to keep him on your side, I guess, once they know a certain amount. And again, there were signs that he actually was starting to get into the mood to talk at the time he was killed. So talk about that part, the double homicide.
You know, the guy who sent me his memoir, who went to rehab with them, who was also a veteran, incidentally, told me that three times officials from SOCOM came down to that facility in Bandera, Texas, and tried to prevail upon Billy to not publish what he was writing, but that he was so disgruntled and angry at the unit, because he was kicked out of the unit. It took a long time. But after his, I think, sixth felony arrest, he was kicked out. And reading his memoir, he was very disgruntled and wanted payback. And so, if this account of events is accurate, then SOCOM knew that he was writing this book, which is very bad for Delta Force, wanted to stop him. Now, interestingly, the other guy who was murdered, Timothy Dumas, was also said to have been writing a tell-all document, but rather more explicitly in the form of a blackmail document. Mm-hmm. He had, according to multiple sources, including one who says he read the letter, Dumas, after being expelled from the military for drug use, wrote a blackmail document in which he named the members of a group of special forces soldiers who were trafficking drugs from Afghanistan into the United States on military planes. That document I've never been able to recover, but it's interesting that both of these men who were murdered on Fort Bragg, you know, had authored documents containing all this embarrassing information for the special forces. And look, I don't want to play coy or like be cute about it. Like, when you're investigating this as a murder, that tends to suggest the possibility that they were murdered to keep them from talking. Now, there's a lot of other people that could be suspected in the murder as well. Mm-hmm. Someone's been accused of that murder. But nevertheless, that is an explanation that was in the mix. It was explored and discussed by a lot of the sources that I interviewed.
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things. There are multiple plausible suspects. But as you said, both of these guys apparently had written things that were more revelatory than the military would have wanted. And the second one done by Dumas, there's good reason to believe that it was on a flash drive that was confiscated by the government. And when you or somebody, some reporter said, you know, can we, what's on the flash drive? They said, well, apparently whatever was on it was deleted.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yes. The only extant copy of that document that I managed to track down was on a thumb drive that Dumas had given to one of his drug trafficking associates named Freddie Wayne Huff, a dirty North Carolina cop who was charged and convicted of drug trafficking and sentenced to 20 years in prison. He's the one who told me that he had read the letter and described in detail what it contained, including the fact that Billy Levine was one of the members of this Fort Bragg cartel. That's where the name of the book comes from. And that thumb drive that was entrusted to Freddie Huff was in his house when he was arrested. And sure enough, the Winston-Salem Police Department had seized it and had it in their evidence room. And I spent more than a year trying to get my hands on a copy of it with Huff's permission. And when they finally agreed, they told me, oh yeah, we looked at it and yeah, it's blank. There's nothing on there.
Yeah, and by the way, Huff is another suspect, and to my mind, a hard one to entirely dismiss. I don't know. I'd like to learn more about that guy. But anyway, he's in prison now. So they described we didn't get to the actual murder scene, I guess. So two guys are found together on Fort Bragg.
Yeah, yeah. Billy Levine had been shot multiple times in the chest. And had been wrapped in a sort of blanket or tarp, placed into the back of his own truck. Then at least two people drove his own truck out to Fort Bragg, to a remote part of the base that's heavily wooded and it's right by a lake. And the truck apparently got stuck in the woods out there, which may have had an effect on what took place subsequently, because Dumas was one of those people that went out there with the body. And Dumas didn't survive whatever came next. He was left on the ground, killed execution style, near Billy's truck. And then the third person or persons who were there left without leaving any guns, money, or drugs behind. The scene had been sterilized, and whoever had been the last person standing or multiple people standing, they got out of there. According to what I've heard, without even leaving footprints. It was a very professional job, and in the sense that it left few clues for the CID to investigate, the Army's Criminal Investigative Division, three of whom who were at the scene I interviewed, who described exactly what they found to me. Dumas's truck was found 40 miles away in another county. It had been stripped of its license plate and VIN, and it had been firebombed and destroyed. And that piece of the puzzle in particular to me suggests, highly competent assassins, because it's not easy to get rid of a motor vehicle like that, or to even be conscious of the necessity of doing so. You know, the majority of common criminals in Fayetteville are not that sophisticated.
So this is a truck of one of the victims of the murder. It had not been out to the murder scene, apparently.
We don't know where it had been.
Well, probably they would have seen, you'd think they would have seen tracks. It must have been muddy, right?
Yes, it had rained just 2 days.
Because the truck had apparently gotten stuck, which leads to the official theory of the case by policing officials, which is that it was almost an improvised murder by whoever had helped. The idea is, I gather, somebody had helped Dumas kill Levine. They were going to take him out there, dump the body, who knows, and then the truck gets stuck, and the guy, this is the guy they've now arrested, although they haven't told us enough details for us to judge, but the theory is he decided to go ahead and kill Dumas for whatever reason. Maybe he allowed him to get more money or drugs or something, but so those are the basic theories. By the way, so you said there were no footprints from anybody other than Dumas, even though it was muddy?
That's according to CID agents who are at the scene. I'm not sure how crucial that fact is. I don't know that you always, Fort Bragg has very sandy soil. So it's a little different from you might think.
Yeah, it might not leave it.
Right. It's kind of pine needles. Very easy for a truck to get stuck in that type of terrain. But at the same time, you wouldn't necessarily leave footprints. I don't know how operative that fact is. The fact that the vehicle had been destroyed and that the guns have been taken and all the shell casings have been policed up, I think it's more crucial.
Although there may not have been many shell casings on scene, right? There was one gunshot to the head of the guy who died there.
Yeah, at least one. I never got ballistic evidence. You know, the FBI really kept a lid on this case.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead, please.
Well, I'm wondering, so they burned the truck of Dumas and took off the license plates. I'm wondering, like, why they cared about the license plates. I guess they burned the truck because they thought there was forensic evidence, possibly including their own DNA or something. But I don't quite get them not wanting people to know whose truck it was. I don't know. Maybe. If they want a particular theory of the case to prevail, maybe. I don't know.
Good question. I'm not sure either. But the person that they've accused of the murder was 20 years old at the time. 20-year-old black kid who lived two counties away. No connections to the military. No connections to Fort Bragg. No criminal record in the vicinity of Fayetteville. And who was already facing life in prison for an unrelated murder. So, a lot of the sources that I interview who are close to the case, very dismissive of the possibility that that guy, his name is Kenneth Quick, very dismissive of the possibility that Quick could have been the responsible party and describe him simply as someone, a fall guy that they're framing. But I personally am a little more conservative. I have a hard time believing that the Department of Justice, even though there's so much crazy stuff happening with the U.S. government right now, there's so much institutional decline to be observed. I still am not to the point where I think the DOJ just straight up frames people. So I think that they must have something on Quick to connect him to this case. They've never made any of the evidence public. But even if he was the person who pulled the trigger, as the DOJ alleges, because he's pleaded not guilty, I would like to know then who put him up to it. Because I just don't see how he could have done this by himself. You know, Levine was 37 years old. Dumas is 44. These guys are big time drug traffickers in the Fayetteville area. You know, for this stick up kid to come and take them both out and then get rid of their bodies and their trucks, it seems to, all of the circumstances would seem to indicate a larger conspiracy, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Although they do seem to have been killed at separate times, right? Levine was killed off base and then was shot, we think, in the back multiple times, or do we know?
Different accounts of that. The CID agents who saw his body told me that he had been shot in the chest, groin, and leg. His mom, though, told me that he had been shot 5 times in the back. Now, I suspect that because bullets can cause entry and exit wounds, that there may have been entry and exit wounds. So that could account for the confusion. Nevertheless, I think the important thing to know is that he was shot a bunch of times in the torso, probably with a high-powered weapon, as opposed to Dumas, who was left it looked as though he had been on his knees when he was shot in the forehead with a small-caliber handgun.
So we should say, at that point, Levine was dealing a lot of drugs, using a lot of drugs. His killing of his friend had apparently taken a toll on him. And he seemed to be in kind of a downward spiral. Dumas was a drug trafficker, and they had done business, right? And then Dumas got his drugs from this Huff guy, which is one reason some people think it could be Huff, you know, because things were getting where maybe for both these guys to be dead and no longer talking about stuff wouldn't be a bad thing for him. Who knows? But so there was, you know, the guy was just, Levine was just knee deep in drugs. And that brings us to one of the kinds of blowback. Well, two, really. It seems like the book is partly about the toll war takes on soldiers, or is taking, in the current environment. And just the toll military involvement can take. There's a certain kind of culture they enter. Now, look, a lot of these guys weren't choir boys to begin with. I mean, if you want to be in Delta Force, there's a good chance you like the idea of killing people. But at the same time, there's a culture that seems in some ways pathological, and that's one of the downsides. But then there's also just the whole drug thing. Like, talk a little about Afghanistan. I forget whether Levine was deployed almost everywhere. I forget whether Afghanistan was one, but,
yes,
but talk about, yeah, okay. So talk about the heroin thing and the Taliban and so on.
Yeah. So the history of Afghanistan as a narco state is a story that isn't told often enough in the U.S. press. It's really remarkable how underemphasized that angle of the Afghanistan war is. If you know what to look for, you'll see it mentioned in the big, most prestigious canonical books about the war in Afghanistan. But the more I looked at it, the more I thought that this is the story of the war. And it actually goes back to CIA intervention in Afghanistan in the 1980s, because those mujahideen that the CIA armed to fight the Russians are the ones that turned Afghanistan into a narco state. And the Taliban originally, and a center of global heroin production. And when the Taliban took over in the 1990s, they had an anti-drug agenda and their ideological DNA, and they eradicated, while imposing Sharia law, incredibly conservative interpretation of Islam, one of the aspects of that, not surprisingly, is a total prohibition on drugs. And they got rid of all the heroin in Afghanistan, and Afghanistan for a brief moment was totally heroin free. But then the U.S. invaded in 2001 and teamed up with those exact same Mujahideen narco warlords and put them in power and created a client state out of them. And one of their first acts in power was to legalize poppy production. And then they went on to turn the country of Afghanistan into the biggest narco state in world history that produced more heroin, opium, and morphine than the whole world could consume. And for 20 years, they did this totally out in the open with the full backing of the U.S. military and the CIA. And to the extent this was ever talked about in the news, at the time, they just would blame it on the Taliban and say that this is a funding source for the treat it as if it were two sides of the same coin, the Taliban insurgency and this drug trafficking. In fact, there's no good evidence that the Taliban was ever directly involved in the drug trade to any substantial degree. I think the most you can say about the Taliban is that in some regions of Afghanistan at some times, the Taliban taxed the drug trade and may have funded their operations through taxes on the drug trade. But contrast that with the U.S. client state, where they were just at every single region of Afghanistan, at every level of the government and every component of the government, from the judiciary to the customs to the police to the military, they were all directly involved in the drug trade and were the ones that were producing the drugs. The denial around this is paper thin. I don't understand why more wasn't made of it at the time. But in any case, after the U.S. withdrew in 2021, the Taliban took over and did an exact repeat of what they had done before. They eradicated all heroin production from Afghanistan and had completely succeeded by 2023. And Afghanistan is now drug-free for the first time. And it really belies the claims by the United States during the course of the war that they were trying to eradicate drugs. In fact, they never really made a substantial effort to do so. Those counter-narcotics efforts were underfunded. They were pawned off on the British. The client state worked to thwart them. And for the last 10 years of the war, there wasn't even a pretense of countering narcotics. It was just implicit U.S. policy to allow this industry to flourish unimpeded.
Yeah. So, and by drug free, you mean Afghanistan? There are no poppy fields of any size anymore.
I wouldn't go that far, because there's pockets of Afghanistan that remain outside of Taliban control. But to within 95%, I think is what the UN certified.
So, like, when we invaded Afghanistan, which, you know, as American invasions go, seemed relatively justifiable. They were harboring Al-Qaeda, which had attacked us. And although the truth is, if you look at the conditions we demanded in exchange for not attacking, it went well beyond just turning over bin Laden. But that's another story. Anyway, I certainly wouldn't have predicted that our invading would lead to a massive increase in the amount of heroin available in the world, much of which would inevitably get into the United States. But the fact is, it happened whenever, you know, the governments that we supported there aided and abetted this. And so it's safe to say that there are Americans who have died of drug overdoses who would still be alive if we hadn't invaded Afghanistan. And again, I'm not saying we could have known that. It's just such a good example of blowback. It's like you just never know.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree. I think there's probably a lot of people who died of overdoses who wouldn't have otherwise. Because in the early 2000s and 2010s, the United States was flooded with heroin. China white heroin, they call it, because of its color. You know, especially in New England and Appalachia and the Midwest is where those are the major destination points for Afghan heroin, whereas Mexico is the number two world supplier of heroin. For comparison purposes, Afghanistan produced 1,000 metric tons of pure heroin per year, and while Mexico produced 50. So Mexico is a very small producer globally compared to Afghanistan, but it was still in the number two position and is right next to the United States. So a lot of the desert Southwest and California and the Pacific Northwest, to some extent as well, are supplied with black tar Mexican heroin. But that wasn't the stuff that was really causing the overdoses. In fact, someone who used to use heroin told me that that you really can't overdose from black tar heroin. It's really the China white is what will kill you. And the heroin crisis was massive in the United States from the early 2000s to let's say 2016, 17, 18, when fentanyl really started to take over. And fentanyl, the fentanyl crisis, which of course is still with us, and is indeed the leading cause of death for adults in the United States, you know, that comes directly out of the heroin crisis. So the consequences, the blowback, it's still with us. And we have only really begun to grapple with it.
Yeah, it's kind of unfortunate, given that Trump is trying to pin the whole opioid thing on China, more or less. It's kind of unfortunate that China white became the name for heroin that, in fact, comes from Afghanistan. But there you go. Kind of a gift for him, I guess.
It's just a misnomer. They call it that because it's the color of, like, porcelain. It's like China, you know, it's fine China that you eat off of.
Yeah.
That's where the name comes from. In fact, they used to call the heroin that came from Southeast Asia China white, but none of it comes from China. None of it. Okay. Yeah. Incidentally, the main drug traffic, I would really like to know what is the connection between Xinjiang, if I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly, but where the Uyghurs live in China. Because if you just look on a map of where that Muslim part of China is, it's right next to the major centers of drug production in Afghanistan.
Huh.
And there was so much that was said and written about China's oppression of this community, of the Uyghurs, during the height of the war in Afghanistan and the height of drug trafficking there. I've always wondered to what extent were those Chinese operations in that part of China intended to reduce drug trafficking? Because a lot of those people that were interred, a lot of the Uyghurs that were interred, I have seen that they were interred in rehabilitation facilities, drug rehab facilities. And I feel like there must be a lot of misinformation around all of that, because Pakistan and Iran and every country that surrounded Afghanistan had a catastrophic heroin crisis during these years, particularly Iran. I mean, we don't ever hear about this, but Iran has devastating heroin problems as a result of its proximity to Afghanistan. And China's largely avoided that fate. You know, I won't connect the dots any further because I don't know. I haven't really educated myself on this. I don't know too much about China, but I feel strongly that there is a connection there that somebody might find it profitable to explore.
Okay, so kind of another component of this particular kind of blowback, this particular manifestation, is evidence that a non-trivial amount of heroin not just made it into the United States, but made it into the United States via people in the military returning from Afghanistan. And do I remember correctly that this document of Dumas's that he had apparently been preparing for purposes of blackmail, did that allege something along those lines?
Yes, it did, yeah. Yeah. Specifically that members of the special forces were bringing heroin back on military planes.
And he, there's reason to believe he actually sent the document to somebody, right? Like as a threat, like to some general or something, right? Which is crazy, but.
I don't know if he ever actually disseminated it to anyone in the military. That was his plan. He told four people that that's what he was going to do. He told his son that. He told his girlfriend that. He told Huff that. And then, correction, the fourth source is a police officer who just heard that indirectly from somebody.
Okay.
But to my knowledge, he never actually sent it to them. Yeah. He may have. I just don't know that.
Okay. Listen, as regular listeners know, what we do is we have a public part of the podcast, and then we go into what's called overtime, which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which you can become at the Non-Zero newsletter by clicking on this post or by clicking a link in the show notes. And you've been kind enough, Seth, to say you'd stick around for some of this, although I know you have a busy media schedule these days now that you're a New York Times bestseller. So in a couple of minutes, we're going to do that, but go into overtime. But first, I wanted to give you a chance to say anything else about the book. The book is about so much. I mean, there are entire other forms of blowback that maybe we'll talk about in overtime that I'll bring up. But what would you like people to take away that maybe they haven't heard yet in our conversation?
That although the book delves into all these gnarly subjects and goes into these historical episodes and these foreign conflicts, really at its heart, it's a murder mystery. And you won't get, if you read it, you won't get bogged down in these asides. The book is really stays focused on the primary murder mysteries because there's more than just one, but they're interrelated. Yeah. And it's intended to read like a nonfiction thriller, and folks who are interested in the topic should definitely not be deterred by the fact that it delves into so many of these dense topics. It's not such difficult dense reading as we may have.
It's not a dense book at all. Yeah. And God knows there's plenty of murders and drug use. In fact, part of the story is just the kind of strikingly high number of people at Fort Bragg who have been involved in murders as victims or suspects or convicted killers, and the extent of the drug use. And I want to talk about both of those things in overtime and a whole nother form of blowback, actually. And if we have time, talk a little bit more about the suspects and the murders, because I spent a certain amount of time playing detective in my mind and wanted to see what you think of my findings. So anyway, encourage everybody to buy the book. Really, it just sheds a light on stuff we need to know and don't have a very clear idea about so far. All right.